From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Some conservatives who supported the war in Iraq are now having second thoughts and want us to pull out. William Kristol criticizes them for wanting to throw in the towel. Kristol is the editor of the neoconservative magazine The Weekly Standard and co-founder of the think tank The Project for the New American Century, which advocated regime change in Iraq even before the attacks of September 11th. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with Kristol about how his projections compare with the reality of the war and the Bush administration's handling of it. Also, book critic Maureen Corrigan reviews the Jane Austen Book Club by Karen Joy Fowler. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Deputy Secretary of State Richard Armitage and Deputy Defense Secretary Paul Wolfowitz were on Capitol Hill today defending the Bush administration's plan to transfer sovereignty to Iraq in 6 weeks. NPR's David Wellner reports from the Capitol.
The State Department first said early May, then mid-May. Now Deputy Secretary Armitage says it will be late May or the first week of June before members of a new interim government in Iraq are announced.
I would say that we have a month or so, roughly, to work with the Iraqi interim government to make it very clear what sovereignty means. And it's not limited. They are sovereign.
And Deputy Defense Secretary Wolfowitz said there will be a big push to stand up more Iraqi security forces, even as 138,000 U.S. troops stay on there.
So I think we're on a course to substantial Iraqi security forces by the end of this year. But I can't tell you how strong the enemy will be. I can't predict exactly how things will go.
Wolfowitz said it's not possible to know how much longer U.S. forces will be needed in Iraq. David Wellner, NPR News, the Capitol.
The human rights group Amnesty International issued a report today critical of Israel's policy of destroying Palestinian homes in the West Bank and Gaza as a grave breach of the Fourth Geneva Convention. Suzanne Chislett has more from London.
Amnesty International says more than 3,000 Palestinian homes have been destroyed by Israeli forces since the latest campaigns of violence began 3 years ago. But Israel insists the demolition of civilian homes is not a specific policy, saying it is part of an operation to prevent arms smuggling. The human rights group says what's occurring is wanton destruction, amounting to war crimes, and is calling on Israel to end all such operations immediately. Palestinian officials are urging the international community to take action and have taken the matter up with the UN Security Council in New York. For NPR News, I'm Suzanne Chislett in London.
The Bush administration says it would not be proper to tap the nation's strategic petroleum reserve in a bid to reduce gasoline prices. White House spokesman Scott McClellan told reporters that would be a misuse of the reserve.
That was created and formed for national emergencies, and that's what we believe it should be used for.
And not for managing price.
Well, we've seen from recent history that that has a negligible impact, people trying to manipulate the price.
Senator Ron Wyden, an Oregon Democrat, disputes the White House claim.
There have been two major releases of oil from the Strategic Petroleum Reserve, and crude oil prices fell significantly each time.
Senate Democrats say that with gas averaging at more than $2 a gallon, the government should lower prices by releasing 1 million barrels of oil over a 30-day period. In stocks, the Dow gained 61 points to close at 99.68. The Nasdaq was up 21 to 18.97. This is NPR News. 9/11 Commission panelists questioned the former head of New York City's Fire, Police, and Emergency Management departments today on who took charge the day of the 2001 terrorist attacks. Cindy Rodriguez reports from member station WNYC.
The former Fire and Police Department commissioners testified that on the day of the attack, each agency knew its role, despite a history of being rivals. One panel member asked why there wasn't a public safety commissioner to direct all agencies at the site. Former NYPD Commissioner Bernard Carrick said New York is one of several big cities that does not function in this way.
We don't have line authority across the board because we're not the same type of agency. It's not like the military. The military is all focusing on one operation. We're not. We don't do that.
Questions about radio communication breakdowns were also raised. Carrick said 2 years later there is still not a radio system that would function 100% during a similar incident. For NPR News, I'm Cindy Rodriguez in New York.
An independent investigative commission said today that the University of Colorado's athletic department used sex, alcohol, and drugs to recruit high school football players to its program. In a report issued today, the commission said the university's chancellor and president failed to provide strong oversight for the department, but apparently didn't know about its recruiting practices. The report said some football players hosted sex, alcohol, and drug parties as a way to lure recruits into the program. At least 9 women have said they were sexually assaulted by players or recruits over the past 7 years, but none have filed charges. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Sodexo, providing innovative approaches to food and facilities management services throughout North America. On the web at SodexoUSA.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The Abu Ghraib prison scandal, the insurgencies in Iraq, and the absence of weapons of mass destruction, aside from one old artillery shell holding sarin, have left some of the war's early supporters questioning whether regime change was a good idea after all. My guest, William Crystal, is critical of war supporters who now want to throw in the towel. Are you a man or a mouse? He asks in his latest column in the Weekly Standard, the neoconservative magazine he edits. Crystal also co-founded the think tank, the Project for the New American Century, which advocated regime change in Iraq even before the attacks of September 11th. I spoke to Bill Crystal this morning about how his expectations compare with the reality of the war and the Bush administration's handling of it. Bill Crystal, welcome back to Fresh Air. Let me start by reading you a few headlines, recent headlines that you're probably familiar with, and this is about how conservatives who supported the war are now trying to figure out, you know, what to do and where they stand. Washington Post headline, conservatives restive about Bush policies. WashingtonPost.com headline, pro-war press breaks with Bush. New York Times, the hawks loudly express their second thoughts. Salon, time to get out. A subheadline, with the war in Iraq turning into a nightmare, increasing numbers on the left and the right are calling for America to withdraw. Another Salon headline, breaking GOP ranks. From where you sit, what is the split with among people who supported the war look like now to you?
Well, obviously, Terry, conservatives aren't homogeneous and conservatives aren't automatons, and we have differences of opinion about where to go now. We had differences of opinion, obviously, about whether to go to war. It was not a universal position among conservatives that the war was necessary or just. I was a strong hawk, and I remain that, an unapologetic hawk. I've been very critical of the Bush administration's management of the war really since the beginning, since April, even before April, in terms of the number of troops. That is April of last year. And I continue to be critical of the administration's management of the war, but I'm not having second thoughts in the sense that I do think it was the right thing to do, really a necessary thing to do, and I still think it's winnable.
What are some of the problems you hadn't bargained on?
I think I underestimated the depth of the Ba'athist sort of tentacles in the Sunni community in Iraq. I think if you had told me that a year from now Kurdistan would be entirely almost quiet, that the Turks would accept a fair degree of autonomy for the Kurds in Iraq, that the rest of the Iraqis would accept a fair degree of autonomy for the Kurds, that's good news up north. I think the Shia in the south have been much better than people expected, actually. The majority of them clearly want to move towards some form of democracy, not quite what we might wish, but perfectly acceptable, I think, decent democracy. Grand Ayatollah Sistani has been a responsible voice. Sadr has not picked up much support in the Shia community. So I think that, too, is good news. The Sunni triangle has been very tough. We all, I guess, underestimated the degree to which there would be recruitment opportunities for Saddam loyalists and for jihadists among the Sunnis. I think we made terrible mistakes that made that easier, unfortunately. But, you know, look, all wars have surprises. Plans, change when they make contact with reality. My main criticism of the Bush administration is they didn't adjust their plans nearly quickly enough when they made contact with reality.
Critics of the war said that winning the peace would be much more difficult than winning the war. As we're faced still with insurgencies from both Shia and Sunni, Do you think that maybe they had a point?
Sure, I always thought winning the peace would be more difficult than winning the war. I'm not sure we should call it a peace, actually. I think it's just it's finishing the war. And one problem, ironically, is that the war went so quickly. Some of the Republican Guard divisions melded back, especially in and around Fallujah, into the woodwork there. And that we didn't, if we'd won the war, if the war had been tougher, the peace, in a way, might have been easier. But, you know, this is all, hindsight is 2020, and there's no point second-guessing that. If we had had more troops, if we could have come in from the north through Turkey, which, you know, depended on two Turkish legislators voting differently from what might have been the case, we might have crushed many more of the Republican Guard and Ba'athist loyalists earlier on, and the insurgency never would have taken off. So it's been tough. I'm not going to deny that. I've, in fact, been saying that for a year, which is why I've consistently urged the administration to recognize that it's tougher than we expected and to send in more troops. That really is the core mistake, I think. Everyone's going to make political errors, errors of judgment in this kind of delicate and difficult operation. You can get away with errors if you have a margin of safety. We tried to do this on the cheap. We didn't give ourselves much of a margin of error. Once the Sunni insurgency took off and we weren't able to crush it, and we didn't crush it up north or in central Iraq, we allowed it to sort of gain steam. We allowed it to build a network. That's been, I think, the fundamental error.
Secretary of State Donald Rumsfeld has had a plan, I think this was his plan even before the Gulf War, to change the nature of the military, to downscale the number of men, to change the kind of arms and technology, weaponry that our military uses. Do you think that his plan doesn't fit with the reality in Iraq?
I think that's right. I mean, obviously some of what he wants to do is sensible, and I think any other Secretary of Defense would have probably moved in that direction as well. But the fundamental notion that we could afford to downsize the military was wrong. And we've argued from the very beginning of this administration and from the preceding administration that it was wrong. Rumsfeld came in wanting to cut from 10 Army divisions to 8, actually. He was so enamored of the high-tech, whiz-bang military. You don't need those old-fashioned infantry ground troops anymore. And I think that's wrong for fighting wars. It's certainly wrong for winning the aftermaths of wars and for the nation building and consolidation and providing security that you need to make this a real success. And I think it's been a terrible error of judgment by Rumsfeld, which he is obstinately stuck to in the face of huge amounts of evidence to the contrary. We have a piece in the new issue of the Weekly Standard by Fred Kagan, a military historian at West Point, pointing out that we're stretched so thin now, that we're going to send a training division, which is used to sort of train our, as the opposition force, I think it's called in the Army, for the troops before they go overseas. You know, they practice against this force. It's a very sophisticated force, but it's really necessary to get the rest of our troops up to speed. And we're sending elements of that force over to Iraq now because we're stretched so thin. So if you ask me to make one fundamental criticism of the Bush administration from 9/11, it would be that we're trying to prosecute Bush's foreign policy, a foreign policy I basically support, with a Clinton-size, well, let's say a pre-9/11 size army. And you just can't do it. It's ridiculous. And they've been just absolutely stubborn on this.
We already have National Guard there. Tens of thousands of troops have had their tours of duty extended. What would you propose doing? Starting a draft?
It's not necessary. I'm not against the draft as a matter of principle, and I'm open to various forms of national service. I think it would be kind of a good thing for the country. But we had a 2.1 million men army, or at least million men and women armed services under Clinton, which was at the beginning of the Clinton administration. That was an all-volunteer army. We've taken it down to about 1.45 million. We could certainly go up two or three divisions to about 1.6 without a draft, and we should have done that 2 years ago, and we still could do that. As I say, I'm not sort of in principle, you know, against a draft, but it's certainly not necessary to be able to get two or three more divisions, which is certainly, I think, what we need now.
Let me ask you about Abu Ghraib. I mean, one of the biggest arguments for going into Iraq, in addition to weapons of mass destruction, was to create a democracy in the Middle East that could become something of a model for other countries, and the hopes were that, you know, democracy would spread. The Abu Ghraib prison scandal is, how much of a problem do you see that as being? Because if going into Iraq was about bringing our values there, our democratic values, and what people are seeing around the world are pictures of our men and women sexually humiliating and physically coercing prisoners. Those weren't the values we were trying to display.
They're not, and I think our leaders have said they're not. I think we're punishing the people responsible. I don't believe that it undermines the fundamental cause or the fundamental task, and I think actually there's a fair amount of evidence that liberals and Democrats are making some progress in the Middle East and in the Arab world, and I think we could do much more, frankly, to promote that than we've been doing. I don't think we should obsess about Abu Ghraib, to be totally honest. I mean, we should punish the people who are responsible. We should go up the chain of command as appropriate. If we want to have a debate about the rules of under which our military intelligence operate, that's totally appropriate, too. Congress has responsibilities there, and I don't know if Rumsfeld made the right calls in every case. The notion, I don't believe the notion that this is systemic or that, this fundamentally undermines the moral integrity of the U.S. military.
Well, according to Seymour Hersh's latest New Yorker article, the system of physical coercion and sexual humiliation was started as a highly secret operation for interrogating al-Qaeda suspects. But then that system was expanded, and that's what we saw in Abu Ghraib, an expansion of that system to treat some Iraqi prisoners. And according to Hersh, the expansion of that top-secret system was approved by Donald Rumsfeld.
He doesn't really show that there's much of a connection between this alleged top-secret system, which would be used for very high-value al-Qaeda targets, and what these reservists were doing in Abu Ghraib, which it's inconceivable that has nothing to do with. These weren't high-value suspects. This wasn't authorized behavior. That's why they were keeping it quiet from their commanders. Now, look, was there a failure of command control in Abu Ghraib? Should the people in charge have known this was going on between 2 a.m. and 5 a.m.? Probably. I mean, there may have been a bit of a turning of a blind eye. But, you know, it was what it was. It was very unfortunate. It's very easy to sit here and denounce it, and I'm perfectly happy to do so. But then I just don't buy the argument that this was somehow all of one piece, that the entire Pentagon and the entire military intelligence community and all the MPs were sort of engaged in this systematic form of abuse. I think there's very, very little evidence. If it were going on, we would know. You know, there are an awful lot of people in the military. Most of them are very decent people. They don't go around doing this kind of thing. And if there were a lot more of it going on, we would have a lot more people coming forward to say so, as we had in Abu Ghraib, incidentally. Why do we know about this? People came forward and said, this is wrong, what's happening. There's this group of people who unfortunately had a couple of extremely bad apples in it, a couple of very weak, I suppose, people who went along, and then some commanders who perhaps turned a blind eye. But this doesn't seem to have been the norm at all.
What Hersh is saying is that the reason why he has the story is that people who were involved were so disenchanted with it that they came to him. Some of them people in the CIA. He says the CIA was so upset. The CIA had been in on this plan, and they were so upset by it they pulled out last fall. But my question is, where does this leave you feeling about Donald Rumsfeld? You know, you disagree with Hersh, and you think he might not be implicated in the Abu Ghraib scandal, but certainly...
Well, even Hersh doesn't say that. I mean, the Hersh thing really deserves some serious scrutiny. I don't want to get into it here in great detail, and we could, I suppose, go parse the article, but it's a bit of a calumny. I mean, are we going to seriously say that people at the level of Rumsfeld and Wolfowitz all down... I mean, think how you would have to translate these commands. How many Americans would have to be involved in signing off on fundamental abuse for Hersh's fundamental point to be correct? Now, maybe that's the way he thinks people in the Defense Department are, that you can get hundreds, thousands of people to agree to foolish, actually, and wrong, illegal behavior. I don't believe that's the case. But I think a month ago, Kagan and I wrote an editorial suggesting Rumsfeld should be fired, or at least suggesting to Bush that he order Rumsfeld to change policies, and if Rumsfeld isn't capable of doing it, he should look for a new defense secretary. I must admit, in the last week or two, because of the hysteria over Abu Ghraib, I've felt like I have to defend Rumsfeld a little, because I just don't think it's at all fair to hold him responsible for this. But, there could be better defense secretaries. I don't think he should be fired under pressure probably right now. I think Bush should take control of the war, though. This is the fundamental problem. He needs to take control of the war. He needs to cancel, or doesn't need to, but it might be a good idea to cancel all these campaign trips, spend 10 hours a day in the White House getting fully briefed by everyone, make whatever changes are necessary, including changes in military intelligence procedures, if that's appropriate, and really make sure we have a serious strategy to prevail.
My guest is Bill Kristol, co-founder of the neoconservative magazine The Weekly Standard and chair of the think tank The Project for the New American Century, which advocated regime change in Iraq even before September 11th. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. you're just joining us, my guest is Bill Kristol, and he's the editor of the Weekly Standard, and he's one of the founders of the Project for a New American Century, which wrote a strategy paper in the year 2000 that some experts consider a blueprint for the Bush administration's foreign policy, including the war in Iraq. Although, as you're hearing, Bill Kristol disagrees with a lot of the ways in which the Bush administration has actually handled the war in Iraq. Yesterday, the head of the Iraqi Governing Council was killed in a bomb blast. How significant is that, do you think, in terms of managing the future of Iraq? Or, you know, what does it say about the ability to actually create a stable democracy there now?
Well, obviously no one incident, you know, is dispositive. People are assassinated, unfortunately, in countries all over the world. But the fundamental fact is the security situation in Iraq has gotten worse over the last 5 or 6 months, and that is simply unacceptable, and it's a failure of the U.S., and it's due to the fact that we allowed these insurgents to organize themselves better and to build a network, which is quite dangerous and has made it hard, has led to this kind of assassination, has led to attacks on U.S. troops, has led to the killing of Iraqis working with us, and it's bad. It's bad. It shouldn't be this way a year after the war. I don't think it had to be this way. I don't think it reflects any, you know, the fact that most Iraqis think it's a good idea to go around killing this well-respected Iraqi who is doing his best for the future of his own country. It's just that we've allowed these insurgents to mobilize and to network in ways that we shouldn't have, and we're paying a terrible price for it, and the Iraqis are paying a terrible price for it.
The United States plans to hand over sovereignty to Iraq on June 30th. The UN representative is going to appoint interim leaders until elections are held. Those elections are scheduled to be held in January. You're proposing moving them up to September. What do you think that would accomplish?
It would give Iraqis a sense that we're well on a path to their own assumption of real sovereignty, and not being governed by us, not being governed by some people appointed by the UN, which does not have very great credibility in Iraq, especially after the scandals that have come out in the last few months. I think we should have moved to elections much earlier. We said that at the time, but I feel it much more strongly in retrospect, that we tied ourselves in knots. We couldn't have a perfect electoral process. Everything's very complicated. So we never actually got about the business of giving the Iraqis some measure, at least, of real sovereignty. And there's no reason, I don't think, why we can't go ahead and push forward the elections to try to give the Iraqis those waivers who aren't certain whether this is going, you know, they're going to end up governing themselves, and therefore who are intimidated and maybe even cooperating with some of the terrorists because they're not sure who's going to end up governing them. We need to really show that we're committed to helping them establish some form of representative democratic government. So I think elections for a constitutional assembly should be held as soon as possible. We don't want to have the interim government in charge any longer than is necessary.
Do you worry at all that if we do the elections too early, that it will look good on one level, it will look like democracy is happening, but there won't be enough preparation in place for the elections?
Well, maybe. We had a year to prepare, and there's a lot of violence, but there was a lot of violence in a lot of other countries that went ahead and had elections, ranging from the Philippines to El Salvador. And I think it turned out to be a good idea to have them because it really got a serious political process going. And I guess I have enough faith in the Iraqi people. I think they want to have elections. They want to choose their own leaders. And it's not a panacea, you know, and I'm not on the ground. I don't know exactly how difficult it would be. But I think we've maybe let the best in this sense, in this case, become an enemy of the good. And I guess I do think a combination of more troops and more force and more democracy is the way to go in defeating this insurgency in Iraq.
What kind of presence would you like us to maintain in Iraq?
Oh, I think we need to keep pretty substantial troops there, for one thing, just for basic security. You know, for a year, 2 years, 3 years, I don't know. We'll see how it goes. That'd be great if we could get rid of these insurgents and if the electoral process had an effect also in decreasing their base of support, and we could get out more quickly. But, you know, we have a lot of experience with this. Often there are long, lingering guerrilla and insurgent efforts. They don't fundamentally make democracy unworkable. You've had it in the Philippines for a long time, Indonesia, lots of countries. It makes life very unpleasant for the people who are subject to it, but we could obviously tolerate kind of low-grade insurgency for quite a while, but not at this level of insecurity. And that's our responsibility. We shouldn't kid ourselves that the, you know, Iraqi police whom we train can deal with this. We have a serious insurgency, and we need to defeat it.
The president just asked for another $25 billion for the Iraq Freedom Fund. The war is costing obviously a lot of money. I'm wondering if the cost, you know, there was the $87 billion, now the $25 billion, and is it costing more than you expected, or were you planning on that kind of financial commitment?
Well, I didn't know, obviously, how much it would cost, and I don't suppose, I guess no one else did, and that's why the president has to ask for these supplementals. I mean, if you think the war is worth it, it's worth it at this cost. If you think the war is a mistake, it's a mistake whether it costs $200 billion or $150 billion or $100 billion. So I don't think the money is a fundamental issue.
Critics such as Richard Clark say we don't have enough money for homeland security because we're spending so much money on Iraq. Does that trouble you when you hear it?
No. We should spend as much as we need on homeland security and on Iraq. We're spending way less than we spent 15 years ago on defense as a percentage of GDP. And this is an extremely wealthy country. And if we need to spend another percentage of point of GDP on homeland security and another percentage point on defense and foreign policy efforts, we should do so. I mean, this is the world we live in, I think. And I think this money, both at home and abroad, and I would include in this diplomatic money, public diplomacy money and the like, all this money is, not all this money is well spent. Some of this money is not going to be well spent, but that's the nature of government. That's the nature of life. But I don't think we can skimp on this. And I don't think we should, you know, damage one part of our national security effort for the sake of another.
You say we live in a wealthy country. The government is less wealthy right now as a result of the president's tax cuts. Have you supported those tax cuts in time of war and in time of these huge increased expenses?
I've supported them. Well, I had a very strong view on them, frankly. I've supported them mostly as a matter of economic policy and keeping the recession shallow, but I would be happy to raise taxes if the money went to the war for national security. National security comes first. I think we can probably do it on the current tax structure, but if people want to have a special surtax for the war, I'd be happy to support that.
Bill Kristol edits the magazine The Weekly Standard. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, now featuring My Soul Looks Back in Wonder, Voices of the Civil Rights Experience by Juan Williams, available at Barnes & Noble stores and at bn.com. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by the Sundance Channel, premiering the weekly original series Anatomy of a Scene with the making of the newest independent film from director Mario Van Peebles, tonight at 9. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we continue our conversation with William Kristol, who advocated regime change in Iraq even before the attacks of September 11th. And book critic Maureen Corrigan reviews the novel The Jane Austen Book Club by Karen Joy Fowler. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with William Kristol, editor of the neoconservative magazine The Weekly Standard and chair of the think tank, the Project for the New American Century, which advocated regime change in Iraq even before the attacks of September 11th. We've been talking about how the war and the Bush administration's handling of it compare with what Crystal expected. On Meet the Press with Tim Russert on Sunday, Colin Powell said that the sourcing on the weapons of mass destruction report that he gave at the United Nations, which was one of the big arguments for going to war, that it was wrong and misleading. He said he's disappointed and he regrets it. What was your reaction to that?
You know, Terry, I saw Powell at the UN on whatever it was, February 5th or 6th, I think, and I was as impressed as anyone. I mean, obviously, it didn't have it. The Congress voted to go to war way before that report. And again, I think it unfortunately made it seem as if the case for going to war was based on U.S. intelligence, which it really never was. It was based on his failure to comply with the UN resolutions and the UNSCOM and UNMAVIC findings that there was no evidence that he had complied with his obligations, and of course the fact that he had these weapons and had used these weapons, and the character of his brutal dictatorship. So, you know, in retrospect, the Powell presentation to the UN was a big mistake, and I certainly didn't know it was at the time.
But wasn't the fact that the Bush administration said that Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction, or at the very least was just on the verge of creating, that made the case for immediacy? There's no time to wait for the UN weapons inspectors to continue to inspect. We have to go in there right now.
Yeah, I don't think that was really the core of the case for immediacy, though. I mean, God knows I made the argument for the war enough times before, you know, March of 2003. I mean, the case for immediacy was just that post 9/11, we had to make a decision one way or another. And nothing, we wouldn't have learned anything more from waiting a year or 2 years. I suppose, I'm not sure we could have kept the sanctions on. There would have been a huge drumbeat of criticism about keeping the sanctions on. We couldn't have kept 150,000 troops, I don't think, in the region, which was the only way the inspectors even got back in. If you really want to have an upsurge of al-Qaeda recruitment, you know, let's just have a whole bunch of American troops sitting around Kuwait and Saudi Arabia and sanctions on, with Saddam able to exploit that in terms of propaganda. So I think the case for immediacy was more that we had to make a decision one way or the other, and less that you know, some nuclear weapon was going to be lobbed at us the next week or two. Now, did the administration say certain things that in retrospect they shouldn't have, and was there a certain amount of you know, kind of simplification of the argument? Sure, but I actually don't think people were fundamentally misled. American congressmen and senators and the American people and your listeners did not say, you know what, I'm for this war because Saddam might lob something at us tomorrow. They understood that basically it was a geopolitical strategic judgment about whether we could accept Saddam staying in power, given his history, given his record, or not, and that that was a threat to us and certainly a threat to friends and allies in the region. But I think in retrospect, there's been a certain tendency to make it seem as if the administration misled more than it did. Not that they weren't wrong about certain things, but I don't think there was a conscious desire to mislead.
Well, I know a lot of people would disagree with you on that. One of the arguments for going to Iraq was that it would make us safer in the war against terrorism. Critics are saying that going into Iraq has made us less safe. Iraq has become, they say, a magnet for terrorists. It has become a recruiting tool for terrorists, who are saying, look how America occupied Iraq, and look at how they're treating prisoners and Abu Ghraib, that all of that becomes a recruiting tool for terrorists. What's your response to that?
Well, the sanctions on Iraq before were a recruiting tool for terrorists, and obviously our foreign policy in general has been a recruiting tool for terrorists. The worst terrorist attacks were launched before we went into Iraq. I'm not going to deny that obviously they're not idiots, the terrorists. They'll use whatever they can for their propaganda and for their recruitment, and we could use a lot more help from allegedly friendly governments in the Middle East in stating the facts, including the facts that are bad for us, but in putting them in context, rather than simply allowing this kind of recruitment and incitement to go on. But as an empirical matter, I don't think it's at all clear that Iraq has helped terrorists recruit. I mean, terrorists are doing a pretty good job, unfortunately, recruiting before we went into Iraq, and we've actually had some victories in the war on terror over the last year or two. I do think some of the governments, like Saudi Arabia, which had been utterly turning a blind eye to the terror network before 9/11 and really before they were attacked, have helped us much more in getting a handle on that network. But look, the threat and the danger remain, and they were going to remain whether we went into Iraq or not. So, I mean, I think it's a judgment call, and I can't tell you, obviously. It's hard to sit here and be precise in assessing benefits and costs. And one reason, of course, is, as you know, you don't know what the world would have looked like if we hadn't gone into Iraq. So it's very hard to tell.
I've been asking you about things that have not gone as planned in Iraq. But what do you think we've gained by going there? What do you think the United States has accomplished?
We removed Saddam, which is not a small thing, and it's who knows how many people he would have killed if he had been in power for an additional year, but that is not a small matter. And it also, I think, is not a small matter to signal that we are able and willing to remove dictators who don't do what they say they were going to do, who kill their own people, who invade neighbors and all that. It was a huge mistake not to remove him in 91. I don't think we make up for that mistake by removing him in 2003. We don't save all the lives that were lost between 91 and 1991 and 2003. But I think an Iraq without Saddam is a better Iraq than an Iraq with Saddam, better for the Iraqis, better for the neighbors. And if we can just stick to it, I still think we have a pretty good chance of having a positive ripple effect throughout the Middle East, not an automatic domino effect, obviously, and no one thought the whole place was going to become democratic overnight. But we can trigger positive changes, some of which are happening, incidentally, in countries throughout the Middle East, despite the difficulties we've had in Iraq.
My guest is Bill Kristol, founder of the magazine The Weekly Standard and chair of the think tank The Project for the New American Century, which advocated regime change in Iraq even before September 11th. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Bill Kristol is my guest. He is the editor of the neoconservative journal, The Weekly Standard, and he's also a founder of the Project for a New American Century, a think tank that advocated regime change in Iraq even before September 11th. Bill, I'm sure you know this. The Washington Post columnist Richard Cohn once called the looming war in Iraq, this is before we actually went into Iraq, he once called that Kristol's war. I'm wondering personally what it's like for you. Since you were such a strong advocate of the war, and since you were so identified with it, what has it been like for you to actually watch the reality play out?
Well, I don't know. I've just gone about, you know, editing the magazine and making my arguments, and, you know, this is a wonderful democracy, and I don't exaggerate the importance of my arguments at all. I was one of many who thought we should have removed Saddam. We made the argument publicly in the Weekly Standard, I think beginning in 1997, I guess in a certain way beginning in 1991, obviously, with a failure to remove him at the end of the Gulf War. So I wouldn't, you know, I don't want to exaggerate sort of my importance in any way. No, I feel some responsibility, obviously, as anyone would who advocated a policy and then saw it put into effect, more or less. I guess that's one reason that in the Weekly Standard we've been tried to be quite critical of the administration where we thought it was right to be, not for the purpose of distancing ourselves or covering ourselves or anything like that, but for the purpose of being honest about what needs to be done, and also because I really think it's important that this succeed, and I'm very disappointed that the administration has done a bad job in the last year in making it succeed, and I'm worried that it could fail, and I think it would be very bad if it failed. And I suppose at that point, maybe I'll say, well, gee, given how incompetent the administration was, I never should have advocated it. But I would accept, I guess, that I would have made an error of judgment at that point. But I don't believe that they needed to have been this incompetent. I still think they can fix the situation. I still think we can prevail in Iraq. And I guess I spend most of my time thinking about how to do that rather than second-guessing, in a sense, the judgments, you know, I've made and others have made, obviously, in good faith based on what we knew at the time.
You said that you don't think we need to fail in Iraq. What would failure mean? Like, what would constitute failure?
Well, that we have to get out, in a sense, or choose to get out because we can't take the casualties and the place either falls apart or becomes a dictatorship, or both, I think, would be likely. And even if people there are slightly better off than they were under Saddam, it's hard to believe they could be, you know, any worse off. Still, if basically there's not a decent regime there, if the U.S. has been defeated and driven out, I think the consequences of that could be catastrophic, really, and I don't think it will happen. I don't think an administration of either party would actually allow that to happen. I just wish the Bush administration were a little more imaginative and willing to change course here and make adjustments to make sure it doesn't happen instead of assuming that we can kind of slog through with the current military strategy and the current political strategy.
And changing course would mean more troops. You'd like to see that?
More troops, quicker elections. And generally, I think the president has to take charge of this war and be the commander-in-chief and make sure that his subordinates up and down the chain are doing what needs to be done. I think, in a way, the State Department's doing its own thing. The Defense Department's doing its own thing. We don't have a coherent war strategy, and we're a big, strong country. We can muddle through with a certain amount of incoherence. God knows we have in the past. But still, it's risky at this point, I think.
No, it sounds like you feel like you've advocated a policy. The policy didn't play out quite as you thought, but, you know, you're just now advocating adjustments in that policy. So I take that to mean that there aren't nights where you're laying awake thinking, oh, my gosh, things just, like, didn't turn out the way I expected.
Not really. I mean, look, I'm happy to debate this, and I have debated this with many people, and I'm sure I'll continue to. I mean, I'm willing to make the case that the war was right and necessary, that the people of Iraq are better off. And again, to be totally honest, people who take the other point of view have to, I think, argue that we should have left Saddam in power. I mean, that is the choice, and the choice is in the real world. I mean, we don't get to rewrite history and have the best of, you know, all policies. So the choice was to remove Saddam or not to remove Saddam. I'm perfectly happy making the case for removing Saddam was right, and I sleep well having made that case. I do lay awake at nights in frustration and anger sometimes at the administration for all the mistakes they've made and their stubbornness and imperviousness to criticism and to constructive criticism. I mean, look, everyone makes mistakes. I mean, if I had been, you know, if I had Condi Rice's job, I would have made my share of mistakes, obviously, or Paul Bremer's job. Those are very, very difficult jobs. In the post-war effort, if you can call it a post-war effort, let's say the continuation of the war effort, but they've been so resistant to making sort of obvious mid-course corrections urged by Democrats and Republicans alike, liberals and conservatives alike. I do think that's just turned out to be a huge problem. I still think it's winnable, and I think we're going to win it actually. But we've made it much more difficult than we had to, I think.
Let me quote something that John Tierney wrote in the New York Times on May 16th. And this was in an article that was headlined, "The Hawks Loudly Express Their Second Thoughts." And Tierney wrote, "Many Hawks are wondering, how did so many conservatives who normally don't trust their government to run a public school down the street come to believe that federal bureaucrats could transform an entire nation in the alien culture of the Middle East?" What's your reaction to that?
Well, my kids, our kids have gone to public schools down the street, and they were pretty good, actually. And I've never been an anti-government conservative, so I probably, those who really were, the libertarians, were always against this war. Look, I mean, I never thought it would be easy to, quote, transform a country in the Middle East. Could we help them make their lives better? Yes. I supported Clinton in Bosnia. I supported Clinton in Kosovo. Lots of very wise, learned people explained that this was hopeless. The Balkans have had this ethnic hostility for hundreds of years. This was a pathetic effort by us to go in without much historical sophistication and bring about peace. Is everything perfect in Bosnia or Kosovo now? No. Is it still a mess? Do we still have troops there? Sure. Are they better off than when Milosevic was engaged in ethnic cleansing? I think so. So I'll make the case that, you know, on net, in the real world, weighing pluses and minuses, it was the right thing to do. And I would also make it, incidentally, with regard to Rwanda, where we didn't act, and lots of other places. I don't think the problem in the world is that the U.S. has been too aggressive in intervening to stop injustice or to advance the cause of liberal democracy. I know that that sounds like a crazy thing to say these days, and the caricature of the neoconservatives is that we're a bunch of woolly-headed Wilsonians who sort of foolishly think you can transform the world. That's not my view. I think Saddam was a real threat. That was the main reason to go in. But I think if we don't try to improve the Middle East, we're going to live in a horrific world for the next, well, for the foreseeable future. So I think it's both the right thing to do and a necessary thing to do to begin that transformation. And it's not going to be easy or clean. But I think it's within the capacity of the U.S. government working with other allies to do that.
Is this type of regime change something we should try again in a different country in the Middle East?
Well, I wouldn't rule it out. I mean, I certainly hope we have regime change in other countries in the Middle East. I hope we have it peacefully. And thank God, most of these countries don't have dictators with this greater stranglehold and who uses much brutality, Saddam. But yes, I would be extremely unhappy if the Middle East looks in terms of regimes the way it does today, 10 years or 20 years from now. And I think that would be an actual threat to the United States, because this, we've, you know, we made that bet 20 or 30 or 40 years ago. Let's work with these dictators. As long as they're pro-American, we can live with them. We saw what that led to. I think it led to 9/11. It led to a growth in extremism and anti-Americanism and terrorism, the opportunity for recruitment for terrorists. Maybe those decisions were understandable at the time. I didn't criticize all of them, so I'm not, you know, I don't want to sit here and claim that it was obvious that it was wrong to be buddies with the Saudi monarchy, but I'm not sure how many people now would say that was a very intelligent decision to have sustained through the 80s and 90s, and I don't think it's tenable now. So yes, I would defend the proposition, the fundamental kind of insight, I think, of the Bush Doctrine, which is we need to change the character of the Middle East if the world is going to be safer in the 21st century.
In terms of global stability and protecting people against dictators, we're so in need of more troops in Iraq that we've been taking, we're taking troops out of South Korea, in spite of North Korea being a real problem, and we're moving those troops to Iraq. What do you think about that?
Well, I think we need more troops in general, which would allow us to keep troops in places where they do contribute to stability. As in South Korea, I think we can probably get away with 33,000 troops in South Korea instead of 37,000. I don't think it's a fundamental change. But I think, you know, your question is a good one in this sense. I mean, if it turns out that we have to withdraw down our troops and that we're incapable of providing basic stability in many areas of the world, in the Far East and in the Middle East, I think we just end up with an incredibly dangerous world. And people need to be honest and think that through. I mean, if we have to draw down in Korea and Japan, aren't we looking at a nuclear arms race between China and Japan, South Korea perhaps, Taiwan, in the Middle East? If we fail in Iraq, I think one immediate consequence is countries like Turkey and Saudi Arabia and Egypt think much harder about their own security, and maybe they can't count on the U.S. to kind of stabilize the situation, and maybe nuclear weapons aren't a bad idea, and then what does Israel think? I mean, it's just the degree to which we, for all the U.S., for all that the U.S. makes mistakes, for all that it's a burden often to be the world superpower, the prospect of a weak superpower is much more dangerous, I think, than the prospect of a strong superpower, even if we sometimes don't use that strength perfectly. And I do think that's, in that respect, I'm with Bush. I mean, I think he's fundamentally right, his instincts are right about the U.S. role in the world. Obviously, I wish we executed our policies more competently in many cases, and especially in Iraq.
I know that you want President Bush reelected. At the same time, you've been so critical of how he and his Secretary of Defense have handled the war. So why do you want to put your faith back in their hands?
You know, that's a question I've actually stayed up a little bit at night thinking about, and I was on The Daily Show with Jon Stewart last week, and he really trapped me on this, and since he's not as nice as you, and though he's actually a nice guy and quite witty,
he's a lot funnier than I am.
Well, maybe. I'm sure you could be if you wanted to be.
I'm just holding back.
Exactly. Yeah. And he said, you know, so your analysis is basically that Bush drove us into this ditch. He didn't have to do it, but he messed things up so much that we're in a ditch, and we're spinning our tires in the ditch. And so you're saying, hey, let's trust this guy to drive us out of the ditch. And I must admit, I was a little stumped for a second or two. No, I mean, look, you only get a choice between two candidates. And I think on the whole, Bush's view of foreign policy is certainly closer to mine than Senator Kerry's, though I respect Senator Kerry for not, you know, for being responsible mostly on Iraq. I mean, for saying we can't cut and run, for saying that, you know, we need to finish the job. I think he's a little, it's wishful thinking to think that we're going to get a huge number of international troops in to help us. But I give Senator Kerry credit for running mostly a responsible campaign. But, you know, if you look across the board, I think I'm closer to President Bush than to Senator Kerry in terms of foreign policy analysis. But look, one reason Bush is now behind Kerry in the polls by a point or two and is sliding is that an awful lot of Americans who are more wavering, you know, waivers between the two parties, independents, weak Republicans, weak Democrats, who were inclined to be for Bush 6 months ago, for the reasons I just said, are now inclined to be for Kerry, sort of for the reasons your question suggests, not because of some great ideological, I wouldn't say, opposition to Bush or to his effort, but just out of a sense that, look, maybe this was a good idea, maybe it wasn't, it's hard to judge that, but in any case, he did it, but he's turned out to be incompetent at executing it. That is the fundamental threat to Bush's reelection. And right now, I think it's, you know, a 50-50 proposition, because a lot of Americans, or at least enough Americans among the swing voters, obviously 40% of, you know, are going to be for Bush no matter what, and 40% will be for Kerry no matter what. But among the swing voters, the failures in Iraq are crippling Bush's case for reelection, for precisely the reason you said, that it's, you know, sort of, gee, I sort of thought he could pull this off, and he seems not to be doing it well.
Well, Bill Kristol, I want to thank you very much for talking with us. Thank you.
My pleasure, Terry.
Bill Kristol edits the weekly magazine, The Weekly Standard. Coming up, Maureen Corrigan reviews the novel The Jane Austen Book Club. This is Fresh Air. In an essay published in The New Yorker 8 years ago, Martin Amis said, "Jane Austen is weirdly capable of keeping everybody busy. The moralists, the Marxists, the Freudians, the deconstructors all find an adventure playground in six samey novels about middle-class provincials. And for every generation of critics and readers, her fiction effortlessly renews itself." The inexhaustibility of Jane Austen's work is the premise of Karen Joy Fowler's latest comic novel, The Jane Austen Book Club. Book critic Maureen Corrigan has a review.
A few days ago, a neighbor of mine told me that her book club had vetoed her proposal that their next book should be Karen Joy Fowler's new and already much praised comic novel, The Jane Austen Book Club. Apparently, my neighbor's fellow reading group members bristled at the self-conscious cuteness of a book club reading a novel about book clubs, and they also suspected Fowler's novel might be too light. My neighbor's book club is one of those serious book clubs. Sure, the members may polish off a few bottles of wine in the course of an evening's gossip-larded discussion, and I hear that it's rare for anybody to actually read the entire assigned book. But this is a group that always chooses classics like Middlemarch not to finish. Too bad my neighbor's book group is so intent on literary uplift, because anyone who even nominally likes books should just lap up the Jane Austen Book Club. First off, for Janeites, as the worshippers of Austen are called, Fowler artfully alludes to the plots of Austen's six novels as she recounts the meetings of the fictional Jane Austen Book Club, which is based in Sacramento, California, and composed of five women of various ages, marital states, and sexual inclinations, and one 40-ish straight single man. The club bands together for 6 months for the purpose of reading all of Jane Austen. Beyond droll, insiderish commentary on Austen, as well as on the cultural meaning of book clubs in general, Fowler uses the literary setting of her novel to full advantage. The Jane Austen Book Club offers a sparkling rumination on the act of reading itself, and on how beloved books can serve as refuge, self-definition, snobbish barricades against other people, or pathways out of the old self to a wider world. The Jane Austen Book Club was Jocelyn's idea. She's a postmenopausal dog breeder, as well as a tireless matchmaker of human beings, and she contends that it's essential to reintroduce Austen into your life regularly. Let her look around. Because Jocelyn is a control freak, she handpicks the five other group members, including her oldest friend Sylvia, who's on the verge of a divorce, Sylvia's daughter Allegra, who's a beautiful lesbian with relationship problems, and an affable man named Grig, who's never read Austen before. Jocelyn met Grig when they shared a hotel elevator months earlier. She was staying at the hotel for a dog breeder's powwow, he for, shudder, a sci-fi convention. The seventh member of the Jane Austen book club, so to speak, is our omniscient narrator, who uses the royal we, and in the shimmering tradition of Austen's own narrators, finds nothing more jolly than peeking in on the thoughts of the anxious gentry. Here's a tiny sampling of the narrator's wit and worldly wisdom. Each of us has a private Austen. Allegra's Austen wrote about the impact of financial need on the intimate lives of women. If she'd worked in a bookstore, Allegra would have shelved Austen in the horror section. Later in the novel, after Allegra has dumped a thieving lover, the narrator eavesdrops on her mother Sylvia's sad realization. Sylvia thought how all parents wanted an impossible life for their children. Happy beginning, happy middle, happy ending. No plot of any kind. What uninteresting people would result if parents got their way. The six book group members slosh back margaritas and red wine and launch their way into loop-de-loop discussions in which they compare Austen's minor characters to sitcom characters and deliberate over Emma's frigidity. By the time the book group finishes their wet dissection of Austen's last novel, Persuasion, the six members are all either dating or married, though they're not, thank goodness, all involved with each other. It's a happy ending the narrator attributes to the magical effect of reading Austen. Even more magical, though, is the fact that Fowler pulls off this final fanfare without being at all twinkly. The Jane Austen Book Club is a terrific comic novel about a closed society merrily transformed by reading. In the tradition of Jane Austen and her funny girl inheritors like Angela Thurkel, Barbara Pym, Stevie Smith, and Susan Isaacs, Fowler recognizes that intelligence and humor are natural literary allies.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed The Jane Austen Book Club by Karen Joy Fowler. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our senior producer today is Roberta Shurrock. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Salad, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Patty Leswing, Ian Chillog, and Jessica Chu. I'm Terry Gross.
CDs and transcripts of Fresh Air are available from Burrells at 1-877-213-7374. Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by the Atlantic Monthly, featuring Jeffrey Wheatcroft on Tony Blair's March to War and Fall from Favor, on newsstands and at theatlantic.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
The piano's thumping. The dancers are bumping. This here spot is more than hot. In fact, the joint is jumping.
On the next Fresh Air, we celebrate the centennial of Fats Waller's birth with a concert of some of his songs featuring guitarist and singer Marty Gross and cornetist Randy Reinhardt. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
The neighbor's knocking. We're all bums when the wagon comes. I mean, the joint is jumping. Let it be.